We're discussing NOAA's winter outlook and what its modeling looks like over the next few months. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. So the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration provides these seasonal predictions for temperature, for precipitation, drought. What do you predict for this winter's weather? Are you concerned Wisconsin will get blasted by a polar vortex type situation? It's 800-642-1234 for your questions. Barbara Mays Bousted is a meteorologist and instructor for the National Weather Service and a contributing author to the Midwest and Northern Plains chapters of the 4th National Climate Assessment. Barb, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's tackle NOAA's winter outlook. What were some of your major takeaways for their long-range forecast?
So the NOAA outlook for the winter is based pretty strongly on two things this year. And the first is the presence of a La Nina, which is a pattern that we can predict to some extent through the winter and can tip our odds a bit for weather conditions across the country. And the second is the patterns that are associated with climate change. So the outlooks come to us based mostly on those two things because they're the things that we can predict going into the winter.
So those are your two, those two variables really help you then predict through your modeling what we can expect. Going back to La Nina, remind us what is a La Nina and how it affects our weather patterns.
Absolutely. So a La Nina indicates that the temperatures in the Pacific Ocean near the equator are cooler than normal. And those cooler than normal temperatures out in the Central Pacific can and in the Eastern Pacific can change the jet stream. And the jet stream is the river that carries all of these weather patterns toward the northern part of the United States through the winter. So when that gets affected, it moves around the different weather patterns. And there are lots of things out there, lots of named signals that can also affect the patterns. This one just happens to be one that is predictable. And in a La Nina winter, there's a tendency for some parts of the Northwest US to be a little cooler than normal, maybe a little stormier than normal. And is a tendency for parts of the Southern US, like the Southern Plains and the Gulf Coast, to maybe go dry, perhaps to have above normal temperatures. In the Great Lakes area and the Midwest, we are kind of on the edge of the influence of La Nina, but we can see temperatures tilting a little bit above normal or a little below, depending on the year. We also can see that precipitation tend to increase in the north, including in Wisconsin, too.
Barb, what about the impact of climate change? What do you see there?
Climate change has some of its strongest impacts in the seasons that are cold and in the places that are cold. So it's why climate change is affecting Alaska more strongly than Hawaii. It's affecting Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, perhaps more strongly than it's affecting Alabama and Mississippi as well. So in the winters, we are seeing temperatures that are trending warmer, and that's a measurable impact that we've been able to see using a long-term temperature record. The precipitation impacts are a little bit interesting because, well, even if you warm up the temperatures in Wisconsin in the winter, it's still pretty cold, right? It's just a little bit less below freezing, but it's probably still below freezing. So precipitation is kind of tipping a little bit higher in the winter too, which can mean that it's more likely to snow. It sounds a little backwards when you're thinking climate change and warming, but it turns out that because you can increase that chance for precipitation and Wisconsin's cold, even if you warm it up a little, that tips the odds a little bit toward that increase of snowfall, at least for a while.
But that would also alleviate some of the drought conditions.
It could, absolutely. Certainly a wet winter can help. What really alleviates drought is precipitation that can get into the ground. And in the winter, you know, that precipitation is a lot lower than other times of year, mm-hmm. and it doesn't always get into the ground. It sometimes runs into the rivers and runs away. So what we need is for that to stick around, get into the ground during the thaw, and maybe get some spring precipitation too.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Barb Mays, Bausted meteorologist and instructor for the National Weather Service. We're discussing weather forecasting models, predictions for our Midwest winter, and NOAA's outlook. You can join in with your questions. What do you predict for this winter's weather? And what questions do you have about how meteorologists do their job? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Joe now in Eau Claire. Hi, Joe. What is your question?
Hey, question is, what does your guest think about the Midwest, especially the Great Lakes region? How might we fare in the worst of the worst of the climate catastrophes, considering our natural resources and
considering our where we are positioned and the impacts we're seeing now from climate change, how might it that affect us here in Wisconsin and the Midwest? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, compared to the rest of the country.
Okay. Barb, are we somewhat insulated, or will we feel the effects all the same?
I think everybody's going to feel the effects. It's just a matter of how. If we look ahead to climate change predictions, and Joe, you mentioned specifically sort of the most extreme of those predictions. Certainly, warming is a continued pattern, and not just in the winter, but in all months. So in the summer, heat could be more of a challenge in Wisconsin than it has been. Usually, Wisconsin's not where you think of when you think of strong heat waves, but that's something that could creep in. Also, precipitation is trending higher, which is good and bad. Precipitation, being wet enough does help. That excess of wet, though, is always a problem and a concern. So it sets up, the potential for increased flooding in the area, perhaps the potential for washing out some of our infrastructure, bridges and roads that then cost money to rebuild. And when you change the temperature and moisture profiles, you change what kind of plants thrive and what kind of creatures follow them. So it may change the animal patterns. It may introduce pests that had not been introduced into Wisconsin before. I don't know about you, but wet and warm in the summer sounds to me like mosquito weather.
it infiltrates ecosystem. It has a change on the whole ecosystem.
Absolutely. Everything sort of feeds back too, right? So as you change the composition of what can grow and thrive, you change a bit of how the landscape responds to the moisture and to the heat too.
As we enter winter here, we still have memories of that polar vortex year and just, what happened. Was that an anomaly, or will we see those types of temperatures again?
It is, it's Wisconsin, right? It's kind of a far north climate in the United States. So it is very likely as we go forward that there will still be these cold winters and very cold outbreaks in the area. The polar vortex is always there. It's always present up at the North Pole. And it goes through phases too. It goes through strong phases where everything kind of stays up there and stays locked away. Mm-hmm. And it goes through weak phases where it wobbles and weaves and it drops these sort of low pressure systems down into different parts of either our country or Europe. And it's a little bit of a matter of luck where those set up, or a little bit of randomness. But when they do come across the United States, they will definitely continue to bring that cold and snowy weather. There is some research out there too about the relationship between climate change and the polar vortex. Some indications perhaps that climate change weakens the polar vortex, making these cold outbreaks more likely to occur. Again, it sounds backwards, right? Climate change should be warming, but it brings these chances for the big swings too, the big extremes.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing winter season predictions with National Weather Service meteorologist instructor Barb Mays Bausted. How much faith do you have in weather forecasts? Do you use these forecasts to plan trips? What questions do you have for a Midwestern meteorologist? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing long-range models and NOAA's winter outlook through February on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Due to La Nina conditions, as we've been talking about, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts that will lean toward above average temps for most of Wisconsin. That's quite squishy, by the way. Your questions for the meteorologist, 800-642-1234. Barb Mays-Bousted stays with us. Barb, you know, you're an instructor for the National Weather Service. You train future meteorologists. What is that training like? How has it evolved?
Thank you for asking. Our training is in a lot of the aspects of what we do in our weather offices. So we're training our forecasters how to issue tornado warnings, how to adapt to changes in our severe thunderstorm warnings, how to incorporate new information when creating winter weather forecasts, and a little bit about climate too. We do train about climate. So we have been very fortunate to have a lot of technological advances in the last few years that let us push our knowledge forward and our ability to serve our public forward. And now advances in the science, too, that help us, do better, make more accurate forecasts, give better lead time, and communicate them more clearly.
It seems like when we see meteorologists, they have so many computer monitors in front of them, and it's very colorful as they look at all of these models. I would imagine technology has changed a lot.
You know, the advance in computing power is one of the biggest advances in meteorology. The more powerful that computers are at an accessible price, the more we can run our forecast models more often with, finer and finer resolution of detail and further out into the future. And that just gives us more information. You know, 15 or 20 years ago, when we were making our forecasts, we'd look at a few models and put together what they were telling us and try to come up with the solution that we thought was maybe most reasonable. And now we have so many models that we lump them together and call them an ensemble. Mm-hmm. And we look at what this ensemble tells us, the collection. It can tell us, what most of the solutions lean toward. It can tell us what the way outliers are, which gives us an idea of, the range of possibilities for something. They can tell us if the models are looking at maybe two solutions and there isn't really like a middle average that they're leaning toward, a two camp type idea.
Wow. We heard from Don in Mequon, called in, couldn't stay with us. Don wants to know, why are we getting less snow? Because when Don sees pictures from the 1950s, there seems to be a whole lot more snow.
It's, the weather we remember is based just as much on our perceptions as it is on the measurements that are available. So in Wisconsin, in most places, the amount of snowfall through the winter seasons is actually either stable or maybe even trending a little upward. But what he might be seeing is that a lot of those early season precipitation events maybe struggle to fall as snow more now because that season is warming up. Maybe some of the spring events also do the same thing because those shoulder seasons are warming up a little bit and precipitation that was already just barely snow perhaps now falls as rain. But it's also possible that Wisconsin's getting, as many of the big snow events as they used to.
Our memories make such an impact on us. Barb, what do you hope and expect in the future as science and technology continues to improve in meteorology? What is on the horizon?
Our advances in science are really pushing the forefront of what we are able to forecast. And I hope we can continue to get more and more refined about, for instance, diagnosing which storms have tornadoes and which don't, or diagnosing exactly where that little band of snow that's so narrow is going to set up with enough notice that people can do some preparation for it. I also think that a lot of our advances are going to come on the receiving side of forecasts, that we're doing pretty well with the science. Let's continue to improve with how we talk about it and how we communicate the range of possibilities, how we reach out to our partners and to our public and say, here's what we think is coming, or here are some possibilities of what's coming, so that they can make the decisions they need to make to live their lives.
I also noticed that weather apps on our phones have become so much more data-driven and sophisticated. It's almost like data overload. I mean, it's telling me so much.
Yeah. Yes, and I think a lot of meteorologists would agree. There is a lot of data out there. There is so much data in the cloud, data coming into our streams. It is a lot of information to process and take in. Mm-hmm. And we have computing help with that, right, that takes in and processes some of that data for us. But it is a wealth of information. And almost like being a meteorologist, folks who are just looking at their apps, instead of getting their one channel they used to watch, may have 10 different forecasts coming at them. And they have to decide, okay, you know, what are the collection of them say? Or is there one I trust more than another? And that's the source I'm going to listen to and, you know, filter it in a way that makes sense to them.
Barb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I always enjoy talking about climate and weather and where they meet.
Barb Mays Bousted is a meteorologist and instructor for the National Weather Service. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, we're sharing some of our favorite stories. Here is producer Steve Gotcher with a story about musician Joni Mitchell's time in Madison.
This story brings together a midwinter ice storm, the southeast shore of Lake Mendota in Madison, ice skating, and a series of photographs that became a record album cover. Dean Robbins takes us back in time to a cold February photo session on the bleak frozen lake.
I remember the 1970s as a time of journeys. College kids like me were forever on the road to discovery, whether hitchhiking or exploring our inner selves. That's why we idolize Joni Mitchell.
I'm traveling in some vehicle. I'm sitting in some cafe.
Like us, this eccentric singer-songwriter was on a quest. We followed her progress from the open-hearted folky of Chelsea Morning to the jaded romantic of Blue to the brash pop star of Help Me. In 1976, Mitchell's wanderlust brought her to Madison in a spontaneous photo shoot on Lake Mendota. Months later, the photographs appeared on an album jacket, encapsulating both Joni's career and the self-analytical post-hippie era she ruled over. Mitchell came to Madison for a February concert at the Dane County Coliseum in the midst of an ice storm. She'd just broken up with her longtime boyfriend and called off the rest of her troubled tour, so her emotional state was melancholy in the extreme. Gazing at frozen Lake Mendota from the Edgewater Hotel, she felt the call of the glassy white void. She could hear tree branches cracking under the weight of the ice, a sound reminiscent of tinkling glass. Mitchell went into town to buy a pair of skates, choosing men's black to match her mournfulness. She donned a long black skirt and a black ermine cape and leaped onto the ice. The surface was dangerously spongy. Freezing cold water splashed onto Joni's face, leaving welts. But she felt compelled to go through with her mad plan. Her photographer followed along to record the strange scene. Mitchell was surprised to find that her cape acted as a sort of sail. She spread her arms and let the wind carry her, looking like a crow in flight. The photographs captured a mystical moment, an artist on an unearthly journey, destination unknown and arrival uncertain. Joni liked the photos so much that she used them for black and white montages on her album Hegira. The title is an Arabic word meaning journey, and the wintry images fit perfectly with the musical message. Chilled by jazz rock guitar, the songs are less melodies than moods. They're less pop than poetry. In Coyote, Amelia, and other meandering masterpieces, Mitchell evokes the restlessness of the road, mirroring the restlessness of her soul. Jaco Pastorius's prodding bass seems like a stand-in for the psychic obsession she can't let go of. Rolling Stone picked Hegira's cover as one of the best ever. But for a Madison resident, it has special meaning. It shows us that frozen Lake Mendota is not just a place for casual recreational activities. It can also be something far more mysterious, an expanse of endless possibility.
you still have your music. And I've still got my eyes on the land and the sky. You sing for your friends and your family. I'll walk green pastures by and by.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And ahead this hour, you have a line to Attorney General Josh Call. What questions do you have for the state's top law enforcement official? What public safety effort could reduce violent crime where you are? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Homicides are up across large cities across the nation, but Milwaukee is experiencing unprecedented numbers of violent crimes. Police there say the crimes are being committed by younger people, and homicides are likely connected to the city's car thefts and reckless driving increases. Corrine Hess has more.
Last month, a 47-year-old Oshkosh woman tried to stop four teenagers from stealing a car at a Holiday Inn Express just outside Milwaukee and Wauwatosa. The woman was killed when one of the boys got into her car, pushed her out, and ran over her several times. The criminal complaint contained horrific details that led to a 13-year-old boy being charged as an adult. He faces six felony charges and up to 115 years in prison if convicted. The case is extreme, but it's one of the many violent crimes in Milwaukee County where young people are involved. Nick Desiato is the chief of staff at the Milwaukee Police Department. He says teens have easy access to guns, and younger people are stealing cars and driving recklessly, which is all connected.
And while those may seem like a very distinct category, a reckless driver who drives another vehicle and kills somebody is still a form of a homicide, or the contributing factor for somebody else's death.
At a small business hub in Milwaukee's Sherman Park community, activist Vaughn Mays says when he was a kid, he was committing crimes too, but now the stakes are much higher. At 15, he was doing what he called block banging. Now 34, he says it's still happening, but today kids as young as 12 are using guns instead of fists and posting the violence on social media to gain notoriety.
It's like reality TV on steroids.
One video posted on Facebook Live and obtained by WPR depicts three young women dancing and laughing while pointing a semi-automatic weapon at the screen. Sometimes the videos show teens or young people in stolen vehicles driving recklessly through crowded city streets. Mays believes young people have a live fast, die young attitude, which has made everything more dangerous in the city. But that doesn't mean they aren't still kids, many without much family support.
A lot of these kids, when you talk to them, like when they in these cars and they got these guns, they like the most tough person ever. But if you catch them outside of that, they're not like that at all. They're very scared, frail, fragile, sensitive.
Milwaukee police officials don't dispute Mays' claims. Homicides are up about 32% in large cities across the nation, but Desiato says no city has been hit harder than Milwaukee, which has seen an increase three times the national average. There were 190 homicides in Milwaukee last year, the most on record. Through last week, the city was on pace to pass that number. Today's version of block banging can't be blamed entirely for that increase. Domestic violence homicides are up, and Desiato says many shootings are retaliation for previous crimes.
Is this an ongoing thread? Is this something that we can somehow get ahead of and be proactive, whether through the means of law enforcement or through some of our partners?
Some residents and communities, like Sherman Park, are skeptical law enforcement can stem the violence. When about a dozen gunshots rang out one October afternoon, Patricia Norman and her daughter barely flinched, even though the shots sounded close to their quiet, tree-lined street, and they were on their porch.
To me, I don't get scared. I mean, if I feel like it's real close, I know what to, if I'm sitting out here, I know what to run my butt in the house.
Norman moved back to Milwaukee about 2 years ago and loves the city, but sometimes she feels hopeless.
Because if they can't get the guns out these kids' hands, then ain't nothing they can do. Because it's not going to stop. I don't see where it's going to stop. And I don't see what nobody can do about it.
A few days after the Oshkosh woman was murdered, a Milwaukee County judge told the 13-year-old the nature of his charges, including first-degree reckless homicide, could not be more serious. The boy told the court he understood, and he wanted to call his mom. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, you have a line to Attorney General Josh Call. A bit of a roadmap here for our conversation. We'll get reaction to the GOP election probes. We'll check in on the Clergy and Faith Leader Abuse Initiative next steps. We start, though, with the package of proposals unveiled this week focused on community-based crime prevention and mental health. How do you think lawmakers should respond to this sharp increase in violent crime? What can be done to make communities safer? 800-642-1234. Attorney General Josh Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
This spike in homicides is hitting so many communities so hard, Milwaukee, of course, and beyond. What does your new package do to temper this rash of violent crime?
Yeah, I'm calling for a swift action from the legislature and concrete action to reduce crime and to strengthen communities. And I think first it's important to look at where we are. There are a number of communities, and Milwaukee is certainly a good example of this, that have faced significant underinvestment in vital services, and that's been particularly true from our state legislature. And the pandemic has led to increased isolation and the interruption of services that were otherwise available. And amid that, we have seen some very serious consequences in terms of shootings and opioid overdose deaths. And I'm calling for the legislature to reinvest in our communities with a $115 million investment. And we've laid out a series of proposals for a comprehensive approach. But there are four basic goals. One is to strengthen community trust and prevent crime. A second is to keep guns out of the hands of people who have been shown to be dangerous. This is being driven, this homicide spike, by gun violence. Third, addressing substance use disorder and mental health crises more effectively. And then fourth, making sure that we have policies in place that will hold the offenders accountable.
Looking at the situation with guns, the FBI is tracking record sales of firearms, huge jump in federal background checks, a shortage of ammunition in Wisconsin. When you look at those numbers, what then in your package will help address this deluge of guns flowing into communities?
Yeah, our office conducts many of the background checks that take place in Wisconsin, and we've seen a significant spike in the number of background checks that are being requested. What I think we need to do is, like I said, take steps to keep firearms out of the hands of people who've been shown to be dangerous. Right now, we don't have universal background checks in Wisconsin. And one of the things that we've proposed here, which we've proposed before, but we're going to keep advocating for until the legislature takes action, is to expand background checks so that there's a background check conducted for every firearm purchase in Wisconsin. We've also included a proposed prohibition on ghost guns, so that people can't evade background checks that way. And I think when there are repeat offenses of felon in possession or straw purchasing offenses, we need to increase the felony classification for those offenses. And then last, we've proposed a red flag law, which would allow a judge to make a determination if there's somebody who's a danger to themselves or others, and if so, to temporarily remove firearms from that person.
As you mentioned, this package does contain universal background checks and a red flag law. These haven't gained traction in the past with Republican lawmakers. Is there a different strategy here, or what has changed?
Well, I'm hoping that Republican lawmakers in the legislature will look at what's happening in cities across the country and see the impact that gun violence is having on driving this spike in homicides and take action. Now, you know, I recognize that the Republican legislature members of the legislature are unlikely to take this up wholesale, But this is a comprehensive proposal. There are a number of different ideas here for preventing crime and for making sure that offenders are held accountable. And I'm hopeful that we will see members of the legislature engage with these ideas and take some action. You know, one of the other things we talk about is investing in community policing and prosecution, violence prevention programs, and reentry programs that can reduce recidivism. So there are some significant funding investments that will also help reduce crime and reduce shootings.
The package creates funding for at least 6 jobs in DOJ focused on violent crime or officer training, more funding for toxicology positions at the state crime lab. Why not add prosecutors? Why not add criminal investigators to crack down on the violent crime caseload and go after perpetrators?
Well, some of the positions we've suggested for DOJ would be prosecutors who are prosecuting violent crimes. The other thing is we've made real progress in the last 2 state budgets in adding prosecutors around the state. There have been about 70 additional prosecutor positions created in the last 2 state budgets. And, I certainly think we would benefit from more prosecutors, but we've made significant progress there. But what we are proposing in addition to those resources at DOJ is $20 million for community policing and prosecutors so that communities across the state can have prosecutors or police officers in their communities who are working on building strong relationships and holding people accountable. And we've also proposed $10 million for officer recruitment and retention and wellness programs. Officer retention and recruitment are big issues right now, and having creative grant programs in communities across the state is critical. The other thing I would note is this proposal is about empowering communities throughout the state. You know, what works in one city may be different from what works in another city. So we're suggesting grant programs that allow cities to tailor solutions to the specific challenges that they're facing.
You've made strides in recent years to clear the sexual assault kit backlog. Is the state crime lab, as you look at adding positions there, adding funding, is the state crime lab facing any backlogs at this stage of the pandemic?
The pandemic certainly impacted the way that the crime labs are able to do their work. They had to entirely rework their workflow to make sure that people were safe and safely distanced from each other. Fortunately, you know, we've continued to work to make sure that evidence is being tested efficiently. But having more resources will help us turn those tests around faster and get evidence to prosecutors and everybody else involved in the criminal justice system faster. One of the things we're calling for in this package is some other legislation that has made some progress in the legislature. It's passed the Senate twice, but so far has not gotten through the Assembly, and that's reform to our sexual assault kit laws. We're including proposals that would require every sexual assault kit in the state to be submitted to the state crime labs pretty quickly. That's going to help us hold offenders accountable, because when that evidence is tested, the DNA testing can lead to the identification of offenders. So it's critical that those kits are submitted and that where there is evidence, it's followed up on promptly.
Let's bring on a caller now, Andrew in Douseman. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how's everybody doing today?
Doing well. What is your question for the Attorney General?
So given that the rise in violent crime, in particular related to firearms, is primarily in urban areas, how do you justify having a red flag gun law in place to take mostly law-abiding firearms from law-abiding citizens? How do you justify that, given that's not generally where the violent crime is coming from?
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Andrew. So first, I think it's important to note that we are proposing a comprehensive package here that includes a number of proposed changes. Red flag laws in states where they've been adopted have been shown to have positive impacts on safety, and where they actually seem to have the biggest impact is on preventing suicides. There are careful due process protections in place with these laws, and they've been adopted in a number of states now. And they require somebody to go to a judge to prove that somebody is a danger to themselves or others. We have a similar process in the state for mental health emergency detentions, but this is asking for something much more limited than a mental health emergency detention where somebody is actually taken into custody. This is just asking to have somebody's firearms temporarily removed, and I believe, and the evidence shows, that this kind of change can help save lives in Wisconsin.
We have Attorney General Josh Call on the line as we look at the pressing issues facing the State Justice Department. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Attorney General Josh Call on the pressing issues before DOJ. And Attorney General Call will be with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's look at the clergy abuse inquiry. You reported DOJ has received nearly 180 reports of abuse by clergy and faith leaders. What have you learned so far in the investigation?
Well, we're not going to go into detail yet about specific allegations, but we have received information from across the state. One of our goals was to create a safe and trusted place for survivors to report. And given the number of reports that we've received, I think we've succeeded in that. And I've been really encouraged by how many people have reached out. One of the goals is to connect those folks who reach out either to victim services if they would like, or to just give them a place to share their experiences. Now, we also are working to follow up on every report that's made. We have a multidisciplinary team that is in the process of doing that. And we've received reports, like I said, not only from across the state, but some involving different religious organizations and some involving no religious organizations as well. And we want to continue encouraging people who have information or who were survivors of any institutional abuse to contact our office so that we can take their report.
In recent days, Native survivors of clergy abuse and members of the Menominee tribe have requested that you broaden the scope of your clergy investigation and include sexual abuse at Catholic-run Indian residential schools and parishes. Will you do that?
Well, first, let me say that what's happened at boarding schools is disgraceful, and it's disturbing, and my heart goes out to everybody who's been impacted by that. Our review is incorporating all kinds of institutionalized abuse. So anybody who has information about abuse at boarding schools or in any other institutionalized context, we want to encourage them to report to us so that we can follow up. I've had the opportunity to speak about our clergy and faith leader abuse initiative to members of the Great Lakes Intertribal Council, as well as the co-chairs of our Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. And if people have information, we strongly encourage them to report to us.
Let's move on to election probes. Former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman leading one of the 2020 presidential election investigations. Last month, you filed a suit on behalf of the Wisconsin Elections Commission to block some of Gableman's subpoenas. He's cut down the scope of information requests to election clerks and the related documents. How much are your concerns resolved?
Well, so far he cut them down with the clerks, but not with the election commission who we're representing in this. But one of our biggest concerns is that he has been seeking to conduct these interviews in private. And the law is clear that this is supposed to take place in front of the committee. So my hope is that if there are interviews that take place, they'll take place in public, so that the public can hear directly from our election officials and so that legislators can be present for those interviews. Now, we raised other issues in our challenge as well, and if there isn't a change in what's being requested, there will be court proceedings on this. So we'll wait to see what the next step is from Justice Gableman.
If you're just joining us, talking with Josh Call, oversees the State Department of Justice, Attorney General of Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Racine County Sheriff Chris Schmeling said he believed election laws were violated in the Mount Pleasant nursing home, but you are not launching a statewide investigation. Why is that?
Well, first, I think it's important to bear in mind the context that we're in here. You know, he proposed charging five of the six members of the State Election Commission with crimes. And, you know, Dean Knutson, who's one of the members of that commission and is a former Republican state legislator and was appointed to that position by Speaker Robin Voss, you know, made the point that certain public figures in Wisconsin, as he said, are under intense pressure to find someone to be the fall guy for Trump's loss in 2020 in Wisconsin. And, you know, we have seen effort after effort to promote the big lie and to try to keep this conspiracy theory going. We don't launch investigations at the Department of Justice based on politics or based on conspiracy theories. We do it based on facts and the law. And the facts here are that there was a very lengthy investigation conducted by the Racine County Sheriff's Office that so far has not resulted in any charges against anybody in Racine County. And there is no evidence that's been presented to us of similar allegations anywhere else, either in Racine County or around the state. So there's not a basis right now for any kind of statewide investigation, and it's frankly not even close. Our investigators investigate some of the most serious offenses around the state, from homicides to arsons to sexual assaults. And if there is a reason to think that there is significant election fraud, you know, we would be happy to work with DA's offices or local law enforcement to follow up on that. But so far, we haven't received anything like that.
Before we have to let you go, PFAS, dozens of PFAS contamination sites hitting communities, unsafe drinking water. I believe in August, you hired an outside law firm to assist in litigating potential claims. Where are you at with holding polluters accountable and going after these environmental cases?
We're doing several different things to combat PFAS. It's critical that everybody in Wisconsin feels safe and is safe drinking the water that's coming out of their tap. We need to protect our natural resources. One thing we are doing is when environmental violation referrals come to us, we've strengthened our enforcement of environmental laws. But we brought in an outside firm to help consider whether there are claims that potentially can be brought relating to PFAS contamination. So we are working with that firm to assess what our next step should be. We're also advocating for policy changes that will help prevent future PFAS contamination. The federal government, for example, is considering strengthening its protections against PFAS, and we've been leading national groups of AGs in advocating for those stronger protections. So the efforts to bring potential enforcement actions are continuing, and our efforts to strengthen protections for people across the country and in Wisconsin are continuing as well.
Attorney General, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Josh Call is the Attorney General of Wisconsin. Just ahead, Netflix has a new limited series out on Milwaukee-born athlete Colin Kaepernick. We talk about his activism with Dave Zirin, the sports editor for The Nation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.